Владимир Путин и Реджеп Таип Эрдоган встретились
впервые. Владимир Путин встретился с президентом Ирана Хасаном Рухани.
Сближение Эрдогана с Москвой вызвало переполох.
Путин отметил прогресс в российско-иранских отношениях.
Российское государство лично поприветствовал всех членов турецкой
международной конференции. You can call it the authoritarian international, you can call it the strongman's club, or you can call it the axis of autocrats. But by whatever name, Vladimir Putin is clearly working overtime to build alliances with the illiberal regimes of the world. From China to Iran to Turkey to Venezuela to Syria, the Kremlin leader appears to be trying to build a global anti-Western alliance to challenge the rules-based post-Cold War international order. But is it a true challenge or an act of desperation? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Oxford, England, is veteran Kremlin watcher James Scher, an associate fellow with Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program. Welcome back to the podcast, James. Always good to see you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. And also joining us via Skype from Newton, Massachusetts, is Daniel Dresner, a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a columnist for The Washington Post, and author of the books Theories of International Relations and Zombies, and the recently published The System Worked, How the World Stopped Another Great Depression. Welcome back, Daniel. It's also great to see you.
Good to see you as well, Brian.
So let's start with the particular here and work up to the general. Putin's alliance building was on display this week when the Kremlin leader met with the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani in Baku and with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in St. Petersburg. James, what do you see Putin trying to accomplish in each of these cases, and how do you see it fitting into a larger strategy?
Well, I have to start a bit with the general in order to answer the particular. I think, you see, the key issue is not that Putin has an affinity with other authoritarian rulers. I think he has a strictly pragmatic calculus. He is a man who will do absolutely anything if he believes it will advance Russian interests. And he will work with anyone, whether they are a guardian angel or a figure like Assad, who is making war on 80% of his people, if he believes that that relationship will advance Russian interests. So that is part of what is going on here. He also understands that all of these people we're talking about live in geopolitically dangerous neighborhoods. And in a geopolitically dangerous neighborhood, there are two questions that really matter. First is, who can protect me? And the second is, who can hurt me? And I think over the past 8 years, a lot of these players have come to the conclusion the United States is not terribly interested in protecting us. It doesn't want to, and maybe it doesn't know how to. And we've had ample demonstration that the Russians know how to hurt us. So Russia becomes then the indispensable partner for them. And the third general point is that we're talking about a region starting in the Caspian and moving all the way over into the Near East. And for the West, this whole mega region is full of lots of little problems that we look at on their merits. But for the Russians, it's two parts of an integrated whole, and the linchpin of all of this is the South Caucasus. So they tend to have a much more of a strategic and integrated optic in looking at what is going on there. So I just make these prefatory points, which Dan might support or disagree with. And then, if you don't mind, then I would like to come back and pick up on the specific points about Turkey, Azerbaijan, and Iran.
Okay. Well, first, I wanted to kind of pick on a couple of things you follow up on a couple of things you said there, James, because I agree with you that Putin will work with anybody as long as it advances Russia's interests. But right now, given the fact that Russia's at odds with the West over a number of issues, it's kind of excluded from the Western club in a lot of ways. And given that Putin, as we've discussed previous times in this podcast, is devoted to overthrowing the kind of liberal rules-based international order, doesn't that naturally make him gravitate toward the authoritarians in this situation?
I think quite sincerely he would say, I'm not at odds with the West. I'm at odds with the people at the moment who seem to be making Western policy. I got lots of support in the West from all sorts of political movements and parties.
authoritarian and xenophobic.
Possibly even from the new British government, which had some unsettling things to say about Russia over the past week, and from the opposition party in Germany, and so on. And the West is now in motion. It's in ferment and turmoil. So you know, I would, if I could be the best of friends with the UK and Germany tomorrow, I'd be delighted to do so, whether they legalize gay marriage or not.
Mm, so you wouldn't even say he's at odds with the liberal West?
No, that is not what matters to him. It helps build constituencies at home and in the periphery, and persuade them that Russia is geopolitically distinctive, important, and like them, believes in identity and will protect them from this postmodern, mechanistic, decadent, chaotic civilization.
Mm.
Yeah, that's very helpful to him. But he'll cooperate with anyone who he needs to.
Daniel, what are your thoughts? What do you see here?
Well, I suppose I would push back a little bit on this, in the sense of, when Putin has had the opportunity, when democracies have tried to cooperate with Putin, it's not always obvious that he's completely reciprocated. I'm thinking of Syriza, for example, in Greece, when they looked to Putin as a potential alternative when the EU was trying to deal with them on austerity. And, you know, Putin made a show of meeting with the head of Syriza, but never actually offered serious material support. Similarly, when Iceland was in serious straits back during the 2008 financial crisis, again, they actually looked to Putin, and Putin didn't necessarily extend the hand of friendship all that much. But that said, I do think I agree with James that it's not so much that Putin is trying to create this axis of authoritarianism in some sort of grand ideological movement. I think it's actually more the case that these authoritarians need Putin a lot more than Putin needs them. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you're talking about a situation where Iran's economy has not done terribly well. Erdogan, obviously, although he's riding high right now in the polls in the post-coup moment, is clearly feeling somewhat fragile. It's not shocking that either of these leaders is going to Russia to make sure that, if nothing else, they don't have to worry about Russia as a threat, and at least get some added legitimacy for meeting with, you know, a great power that is in their neighborhood. So in that sense, I think Putin is certainly opportunistic and will obviously be happy to talk to any middle power leader that wants to talk to him. Same with Egypt Sisi, for example. But I don't think any kind of claim that he's somehow trying to wrap all of this up in a grand ideological opposition to the West, I'm certainly sure that he's willing to play that card, but it's not a card that I think he cares all that much about. I think Western commentators care about it a lot more than he does, I guess would be the way to put it.
So you see him as a cold-hearted realist, is the
Oh yeah, yeah. No, he's a brutally effective tactician and a remarkably incompetent strategist. That would be the way I would describe it.
Yeah, no, I would concur with that. But I would also argue, though, that a little pushback, a little bit on the point that these authoritarian leaders need Putin more than he needs them. In the Sino-Russian relationship, for example, China clearly has the upper hand. Clearly.
Absolutely. Right. No, that's a fair point. But I mean, but China is the only other actor out there that's an authoritarian state and more powerful than Russia.
And nobody in Russia pretends otherwise.
Yeah, no, they're very realistic about this. In the case of Iran, though, post Iran nuclear deal with sanctions lifted and the West kind of being opened up to Iran, I'm not sure. I think Iran can probably play both sides against the middle as well. No,
I don't think so. Part of the problem that Iran's leadership has to deal with two issues as a result of the sanctions lifting. The first is, there's clearly fear by Khamenei that the lifting of the sanctions somehow empowers moderates, which Khamenei clearly does not like. And indeed, well, one of the fascinating things was how in the years since the Iranian nuclear deal was signed, you saw hardliners making damn sure that, you know, Rouhani supporters didn't necessarily do terribly well in elections and you know, that the Revolutionary Guard didn't lose that much of their power. The second issue is the degree to which I think the Iranian nuclear deal created false hopes that the lifting of the sanctions would cause this infusion of cash to the Iranian economy, which U.S. conservatives have also aided and abetted. When in truth, it turns out that, first of all, the lifting of the sanctions has not been obviously complete, particularly on the U.S. side, but also private sector actors are legitimately leery of actually investing in Iran. Because beyond the nuclear question, Iran has other issues like rule of law questions and corruption questions. And what you're seeing is a lot of these firms saying, gosh, you know, we'd love to invest in Iran, but we're not going to do it. And frankly, they're blaming the sanctions when that's not necessarily the cause. Mm. So as a result, you've got an Iranian population that is probably going to be turning very quickly against the government because the presumed promise of the benefits of the nuclear deal aren't necessarily going to come to pass. It's not shocking. In other words, I think Iran feels more boxed in than you know, an external observer might think. And, you know, furthermore, Iranian relations with Iran have, you know, preceded Putin in that sense. So it's not shocking that they would would have, you know, a summit in that sense.
I mean, one of the things I kind of see happening here, though, is that, and what you say is right, Dan, but at the same time, European energy companies are chomping at the bit to sign contracts with Iran to get natural gas pumped to Europe from Iran and to do these kinds of projects. And I think Putin's trying to get in there quick while the getting's good before Iran does get opened up. There is, because of the reasons you just spelled out, there's a window of opportunity for Putin now to kind of lock down Iran before it goes to the West. James, you look skeptical.
Just two things on this. First of all, you could have all these energy ties without having a political relationship. What Russia and Iran have is a political relationship, not just an economic relationship. They have a political and military relationship. It's a very complex relationship, and as Dan said, it long predates Putin. I mean, this is a centuries-long relationship, and neither party in this relationship trusts the other.
No.
But they have each usually come to the conclusion, well, we need the other. We need to play with the other. They're important. And you put this in the context now of the South Caucasus. Armenia finds it very useful to have relations with Iran, and Azerbaijan, of course, very strong relations with Iran. And that's, you know, one reason why this recent trilateral meeting in Moscow was so very interesting. Because there are distinctive Russian objectives in Azerbaijan, and I think Putin is a better strategist than Dan does, but if you look at Azerbaijan as a case in point, you could see there have been certain long-term objectives, and the Russians have slowly been making progress on them, and nobody has been noticing. And finally, we turn around and discover that 85% of Azerbaijan's arms come from Russia. The Turkish influence has rather dramatically declined in recent years. The United States is nowhere. He's figured out that as much as his ally, CSTO ally, Armenia, is deeply embittered by the fact that that Azerbaijan gets more arms than Armenia does, they can't do anything about it.
They pay for them.
They're not going to go anywhere. But, you know, that's not the main thing that they pay for them. Of course, that's useful. But you want, therefore, to have Iran on side in Azerbaijan. And then there's this whole issue of the Caspian Sea. The Russian position has been that the Caspian Sea should only be open and should only be open to exploration and development by the littoral powers. That means, effectively, U.S. energy companies and others cannot look for energy resources or develop them in the Caspian. And if you read Putin's speech in Moscow after this meeting with Rouhani and Aliyev, you will see that he feels he's made progress in getting Azerbaijan to much closer to the Russian position on the Caspian and on a number of other issues. Now, all this goes on quietly and steadily, and no one else, no other players around seem to notice it.
Mm.
And these guys who are living there, I mean, I come back to people like Aliyev, they can't feel confident with Americans who are intermittently interested in them and pick up a cause one day and then lose interest and drop the ball, which happens repeatedly. And over the past 8 years, the Obama administration has basically demonstrated it's not terribly interested in anything that goes on in that region.
Now, I know you had some things to say about what's going on with the Russo-Turkish relationship as well, James. What do you see going on there?
Yeah, if Dan doesn't explode, I'll just...
Unless Dan wants to jump in.
I've been emphatically agreeing with everything James has said over the last minute or so, in the sense that...
I agree with his thesis. I mean, I come back to this point, and I think I made it initially. From their perspective, Putin is the partner you've got to have, right? Whether you like him or not. whether you trust him or not. These guys are playing the game. They're on the ground. They're playing the game. Now,
Turkey, hold on. I would just want to intervene to emphasize. It's not just that they are playing the game. It's also, if nothing else, the Obama administration. You can accuse you. There's been a lot of exaggeration on this, but there is no doubt that the Obama administration has made it very clear they don't want to play this game. You know, they're not really terribly interested in this part of the world, and so that, you know, signal gets. And indeed, the few areas where they have made deals, the deals have clearly been designed to have them extricate themselves. So, I mean, I think that's all, something else that's going on is that, yeah. So, sorry, go ahead.
So I'm just saying, you know, in view of that, obviously, if everything goes pear-shaped there from the point of view of Western interests, we have no business complaining, do we? But look at Turkey. I think before the coup, Erdogan concluded for internal reasons that he probably had to move things in a more authoritarian direction. And then he looks around him and realizes, well, the EU has given him some of what he's promised, all tied up with all sorts of annoying conditions about terror laws and everything else, which from his perspective are directly damaging to the EU's security, which come out of some Western rule book, which have nothing to do with the very dangerous security realities down there. And the EU is a fickle and difficult partner. They shot down the Sukhoi in last November. What was NATO's response? Publicly, the weakest sign of solidarity the alliance could muster. Privately, everyone understood. Half the allies just beat up on Turkey as a result of all that. You're looking at Syria. You're looking at the war that Russia is prosecuting there. All sorts of other nastiness. And then you ask this basic question. Who is going to protect me? I think Erdogan came to a conclusion quite reasonably. I cannot put all my cards in the Western basket. I have to walk back from a situation that put us on the brink of war with Russia. And then if I can add the most controversial point of all, which will have people phoning in, I think that the terrorist attack at Ataturk Airport underscored to Erdogan the importance of being on Russia's side when it comes to terrorism and counterterrorism. It was a very interesting episode. They arrested 22 people. Turkish officials said they came from the North Caucasus, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan. The press reported a number of them had Russian passports. The Ankara insisted all this was planned out of Raqqa in Syria. Well, two questions arise, don't they? Can Daesh in Raqqa coordinate all of this with separate players from Dagestan, from Kyrgyzstan, and from Uzbekistan? And then secondly, why would they do it that way? So there are a lot of murky questions here. But if you're watching the way the Turks speedily change their whole narrative and discourse on Russia, I think you're entitled to come to the conclusion that they also got a little bit frightened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know we spoke about this briefly at the NATO summit, and
I'm not saying they have answers, and I'm not suggesting I have answers, but there is enough there to remind them that in this area, Russia can really hurt you. You know, there are Chechens in Turkey. There are 100,000 of them. Most of them are refugees from the mid-19th century wars. And then these new Chechen refugees, about 1,500 who stayed there. And you don't really know who they are. The Dudaevists, the Masharov people, the Russian infiltrated people. And the latter variety have Russian passports. The 19th century ones, they don't have Russian Federation passports. Mm-hmm. Anyhow,
no. Regarding the Russian-Turkish relations, I read two interesting pieces over the past couple of days that kind of that suggest opposite things, and I kind of wanted to throw these out for you guys. There was a piece by Lilia Shevtsova in the FT earlier this week that basically said post-coup, Putin's in a win-win situation with Turkey. Putin's in a complete win-win situation, because if the West cracks, if the West comes down hard on Turkey, it's just going to drive Turkey into Russia's arms with Russia as the senior partner. And if the West doesn't, Putin could say, see, this exposes your hypocrisy. Everybody, why is Turkey allowed to be like this and we're not? So it's basically a win-win.
That's, oh, that's absolutely right.
That shifts off as over. Now, there's a piece in Bloomberg today, however, that said Turkey cannot just simply cannot afford to make a pivot to Russia and walk away from the West. Turkey's trade with the European Union is $147 billion. Turkey's trade with Russia is what? $24 billion. So, well, so these two things, it's kind of get you both to weigh in on that.
I'm not saying that. If Dan wants to argue with me about this, there's no argument. It's not, pivot might be the right word, but it's not walking away from the West and embracing Russia. It's a multi-vector policy. This is something Erdogan in particular has always had. I think he's just adjusting the weight of the vectors.
Mm.
I would disagree somewhat in the sense that I don't think it's entirely win-win for Putin. Shevtsova is correct that if the West continues to critique Erdogan, you know, is going to be pushed somewhat more, I suppose, into the arms of Putin. But if, as I expect, the West tempers its criticism of Erdogan, Putin can't then say, oh, you guys are so hypocritical, look at what Turkey is doing, in no small part because he doesn't necessarily want to. If he does that, he loses Erdogan as a potential ally or partner. And I think he actually does value that somewhat. So, and as you say, the other problem with this is that Erdogan will make a show, obviously, of cooperating with Putin. And to some extent, they're, you know, improving relations from the low point from the shoot down in the fall. But even now, I don't think trade relations are quite what they were a year ago. No. So, I mean, yeah, it's like talking about the U.S. being allies with Iran post-Iran nuclear deal. There's no denying that relations have improved somewhat, but they've improved from a remarkably low base. And just as in the case with Turkey and Russia, I don't doubt that Turkey can have somewhat more warming relations with Russia, but they're not going to leave NATO. They're not going to abandon the trade relationship with the European Union. I think this is one of those times where commentators can overreact somewhat to marginal shifts in diplomacy over the past few weeks.
Yeah, no, if you look at it historically, I mean, geopolitically, if you just look at it in a really cold, hard, geopolitical, realist kind of way, Turkey and Russia are natural adversaries. They're natural adversaries.
Rivals.
Rivals. Yeah, at best.
And I would say, what they naturally have is a complex relationship. And the Russians become pretty good at managing complex relationships. And one shouldn't forget that from the mid-90s, really, until very recently, Turkish-Russian relations were very good. And the trading relations were quite high. There was tourism, there was everything else. And part of there was a certain type of affinity there. There are certain similarities. There's an ambivalence about whether we're European, we're Eurasian, or something else. Both the Turks and Russians have. There's this resentment that Europe doesn't treat us as fully first class people, as if we're naturally part of them. And at the same time, there's belief, we are distinctive and we don't want to be just like you. And these complexes, there are certain affinities, natural affinities between these two countries. If you look again at how the whole South Caucasus thing has played out, it's been both a cooperative and adversarial relationship. I think the Russians are far better at dealing with this kind of murky contradiction than Washington is.
Hmm. I would add to your list, James, that they both are also powers pining after their old empires as well. Although if you push that to the logical conclusion, it puts them into competition with each other. Go ahead, Dan.
No, their spheres of influence overlap. And so in some ways, there's an inherent limit on how close the relationship can be. But on the other hand, they obviously still have interests that occasionally coincide. And since their relation, you can argue that if Erdogan truly embraces autocracy, then it helps to eliminate any kind of ideological problem that he would have dealing with someone like Putin, I guess.
Right. Now, I wanted to jump now from the particular back to the general, because there was an interesting op-ed in the New York Times last week by Joachim Bittner, the editor of the German weekly Die Zeit, argued that there is an ideology that unites Putin and the other members of his fledgling strongman's club. He called it orderism. And I want to quote from it at length, if you'll bear with me. He says, "The ideology's basic political premise is that liberal democracy and international law have not lived up to their promise. Instead of creating stability, they have promoted inequality and chaos. The secular religion worshipped in the Western parliaments was globalism, or in the European Union's case, Europeanization. These beliefs, according to the orderists, overlook the downside." He calls this ideology orderism. Orderism has started to challenge democracy in many parts of the world, Turkey, Poland, and the Philippines. But Mr. Putin's Russia believes it holds the copyright on this formula and sees it as the sharp edge of the wedge that it is trying to drive among the nations of the West. James, your thoughts?
Well, of course, all of this is a complete caricature of both Western thinking and Western practice. Mm-hmm. And it's been, but it's a caricature which the Russians have invested an enormous amount in. Well before these events in Ukraine, this has been building even since the early 90s, the enormous interest, first of all, in the development of the idea of Russia as a European but nevertheless distinctive civilization that sets itself on that adheres to traditional values in contrast to postmodernism, which is all relativism and has no values and is fundamentally decadent. And all of this thinking has been developed by a relatively small but influential groups of people in the 1990s, well before that, in fact, in the 1930s, amongst Eurasianists. There are all sorts of divisions amongst these people, but quite early on they also started thinking about how this could be turned to influence in dealing both with people in the former Soviet Union who have been cut adrift or who have left us. And Putin has turned all this into a system. There is absolutely, there's no question. This is a central pillar of the policy. The question we were raising earlier is whether this actually inhibits who they partner up with and who they deal with in practice, and that's a separate issue.
Well, this is what I'm driving at. Is this ideology of orderism, as Bittner calls it, is this the glue that holds, that binds these authoritarian regimes together? Because you do see what you said about Russia, you could extend that to Iran, you could extend it to a degree to China, to Turkey.
The only thing which does is a negative that these ideologies are all the distinct authoritarian ideologies, and they're not all the same. They're very different in all these cases. The common elements are very few, and the main one is anti-hegemonism, meaning hostility to a U.S. and Western-dominated world. When Lavrov said, 10 years ago now, the West is losing its dominance of the its monopoly of the globalization process, that has resonances even in democracies like Brazil. You don't have to be authoritarian. In Iran, everywhere else. So when it comes to the strength of it is to say, no, you do not have to fit into this liberal model of globalization. Globalization is not what they say it is; it's what we make it. And we live in a world not just that is multipolar, but it's a world, again, this is what Lavrov said, of multiple values centers. So this is clever because, unlike Soviet ideology, you don't have to conform with with Russian thinking and practice. You can be yourself and oppose the real hegemon, which is the United States, and be fully backed by Russia and be fully confident that whatever you do at home, the Russians are not going to bother you. They're not going to make any demands, and they're going to treat you as fully sovereign at home. Again, even if you make war on your own people, you'll put half of them in jail.
Daniel? I mean, is this wishful thinking on the Russians' part, or does this thing have some legs?
I mean, I think there's layers of this. So the first layer, which without question will attract the widest amount of support, is the notion of we oppose U.S. agenda. You know, and they might dress it up in the form of Western liberal order, but it's more the notion of look at all of these panoply of international institutions where the United States either has a veto or is the most powerful actor, and we demand a greater voice in them, or we will create new structures of our own. And indeed, this is the one piece of glue that holds, let's say, the BRICS together. The BRICS are a heterogeneous, you know, and at this point, economically troubled group of countries.
To say the least.
That don't have a lot in common. But one of the things they do have in common is they all resent the fact that they think the United States and the West runs organizations like the IMF or the World Bank or the WTO. And so the one area where they actually all are in unison is the notion of we want a greater voice in them. And so, you know, that enables them to create the BRICS Development Bank and enables them to issue joint communiques saying we demand a greater voice and so on and so forth. And that will generate the widest amount of sympathy, I think, because the villains in that kind of demand are the United States and particularly actually the European Union, which has an even more outsized voice in most of these structures. So that works. Now, if you cut a little bit deeper and start talking about the values that the West promotes, the notion of, oh, look at all this instability and inequality and so on and so forth. Yeah, that's a load of crap. And I don't think that's going to work terribly well as an attractor. First of all, it does suffer from the problem of not being true. If you actually take a look at things like economic inequality across the globe, despite, you know, problems in the United States or Europe, global economic equality is actually fallen dramatically over the last 20 or 30 years.
Yes.
And furthermore, if you take a look at things like, you know, political violence or instability, there is no doubt been a slight uptick over the last few years, but that is a slight uptick from a very low, you know, level that, you know, reflects a 40-year decline, actually 70-year decline in international violence and a 25-year decline in civil violence. So, or in civil wars. So, I don't think that really is necessarily going to work terribly well. It's certainly not going to play with countries like Brazil or India or South Africa, for example. So I think the idea of we want a more multipolar world, sure, even the French will buy into that. That's been a longstanding ressentiment for anyone who's not an American. The idea that American values are decadent, that might play that might play a little bit better in the sense of Putin can now point to Europe and the United States and say, see how badly their democracies are off. See how, you know, decadent it is. You know, I can offer a better way. I have to admit, in the last year, that might have a little more credence than it would have, you know, before that. But even there, I don't think it's going to be that much of an attractor.
Mm-hmm. Just to underscore Dan's point, this is the real objective, political objective behind all of this ideological language and activity is to change the structures of global governance and also, not incidentally to this, to change the security order in Europe. Mm-hmm. But it's changing the global security order as well, and not just security. The global economic order. And that's what this is really about.
Now, if you go down that road, you have to bring into the equation the 10-ton elephant in the room, China, right? And China at this point in time appears more than happy, as much as rhetoric may suggest otherwise, their actions appear more than happy to free ride on Western and American hegemony right now. If you put it in classic international relations theory terms, China is a classic free rider because they know times. They believe that time is on their side. I think a good example
whoa,
of this.
Whoa! I'm going to push back hard on this.
Okay,
on a variety
push,
of dimensions.
Push away.
First of all, I don't think it's fair to label China strictly as a free rider. You know, this is one of the things I argued in my book, The System Work, which is if you take a look and see what China did post 2008. They actually acted like a responsible stakeholder, you know, in the sense of partially they mostly did this for self-interested reasons, I would add. But they didn't raise their tariffs. They eventually, you know, started to force the yuan to appreciate. They engaged in a massive fiscal stimulus. There is no doubt that there are ways in which they act as spoilers, particularly in
not spoilers, things. Free riders.
Right. But no, they've also acted as spoilers. Think about the South China Sea, for example, where they are trying to, or the Senkakus. But I don't think the free rider accusation works terribly well for them. The other thing I would strongly push back on is this notion that China thinks time is on its side. And I think that is possibly what they thought in 2008. But you could argue that in the last few years, the Chinese have become much more sober in terms of the notion of what their future economic trajectory will look like, and also to the degree to which I think they overestimated America's decline the decline in American power. And a lot of the Chinese watchers that I will talk to will say that they actually have something more of a respect now for the notion that the U.S. is a more resilient actor than they had appreciated immediately after 2008. Mm-hmm.
Could I reinforce both these points? First, our most sanguine but sober expert on this subject in the UK, Bo Bolo, has the following metaphor: that China wants to sit in the front seat but doesn't want to drive.
That's perfect.
That's the most optimistic view. But it is also the case, and I think there's general agreement, what China does want, whether it's articulated or not, but it's adamant on this, is primacy in East Asia. And there is worry that if it gets it, then it will be thinking about primacy in the Western Pacific as well. But what it doesn't want, and this is where the optimists are right, no, it doesn't want global primacy. It is not interested in that. It is has to advance its interests in a framework which has largely been set up by others. And in that sense, it's probably less of a spoiler than Russia. But the second point, I mean, Dan mentioned something very interesting about time being on their side. The China, if you're drinking the right stuff and talking to insiders in China, it doesn't take much to figure out why they're so nervous when growth rates slip below 7% a year. It's because there is a society where there are profound inequalities. You don't have this in the United States. In the United States and the UK, the gap between rich and poor has been narrowing. The problem is
The United States. Sorry.
Really?
Really.
The problem, I thought, and even on your side of the pond, is that people in the middle are going nowhere, and middle class living standards have been stagnating and slightly falling. But in China, the inequalities are enormous, and they're not diminishing. Although corruption works differently than in Russia. There is mentioned diversion of resources and all kinds of corruption in the system. If the system is growing at very high rates, people are still feeling a little better this year than they were last year, and they're less inclined to blow up. If the growth rates start to come down to even a high Western level, they're in trouble. The joints start to show, and they. There are no lubricants for the gears.
Now, everything you both said basically reinforces that with my notion that China is not going to be enthusiastic about joining Russia in an effort to overturn Western hegemony. Right? I mean, this was the larger point I was driving at.
The Chinese have no illusions about Russia.
I will say there is one scenario where that could take place, and it has nothing to do with Russia. It has everything to do with if Xi Jinping realizes that if he's so worried about domestic discontent because of low growth, and he decides that he has no choice but to sort of play the hyper-nationalist card, that's where you could see a scenario where maybe he would think, okay, I'll ally with Putin even more strongly, and I'll make this point about how we're opposing the West, and we're going to establish, you know, we're going to turn the Pacific into a Chinese lake. Except that even there, he would have to be truly desperate and not have any kind of long-term calculations to do that, because if he made that move, China's economy would tank immediately. And so I'm dubious that he would play that card, but it is the one way in which I could see it.
I don't think that's going to happen. I think I'm predisposed to think the Chinese are the the wisest and most selfish and self-interested people on earth. And they, you know, after Crimea and everything else, what did the Chinese offer Russia in terms of trade? Tea and sympathy. That's it. Their trade deals with Russia are, I mean, they're the only people who force the Russians to give in over when it comes to negotiating over energy and other and other things.
Any of those deals actually come to fruition?
Sorry?
No, any of those deals actually come to fruition? This is one of the things that drives me crazy.
Very few of them. Very few of them.
They're each willing to wait. And the Chinese are probably willing to wait longer than the Russians are willing to wait. And the Chinese will not budge. I think for the Chinese, the United States is the significant other.
I agree.
And they know that Russia is in no way can compensate for anything that is lacking in the relationship with the United States. The United States for China is a problem to be managed through cooperation and rivalry, just as for the United States, the reverse is true. And that's not going to change because these are very smart people.
And that's a good note to shift gears on. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and shift gears to look at what happened or did not happen in Crimea this week and why. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Oxford, England, is veteran Kremlin watcher James Scher, an associate fellow with Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program. And also joining us via Skype from Newton, Massachusetts, is Daniel Dresner, a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a columnist for The Washington Post, and author of the books Theories of International Politics and Zombies, and the recently published The System Worked, How the World Stopped Another Great Depression. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
ФСБ предотвратила террористические
терактов на территории Крыма, совершение которых было подготовлено главным...
Резкое обострение украинского кризиса. Президент
ФСБ
Путин
заявил, отмечает, что со стороны украинской границы их прикрывали огнем.
Главное управление разведки
Минобороны So the FSB
Украины,
claimed this week that it foiled an attempt by Ukrainian agent saboteurs to enter Crimea and commit acts of terrorism. Coming amid an escalation of fighting in the Donbass and a Russian military buildup in northern Crimea near mainland Ukraine, the claim renewed fears that full-scale war could break out. Vladimir Putin canceled a planned meeting with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and French President François Hollande on the sidelines of the G20 summit next month. James, this is one of those weird stories where there seem to be no facts, just statements and denials from officials. What's your take? But this is one of those weird stories where there are just no facts, just statements and denials from officials. It's a battle of narratives. James, what do you think? And in that sense, it's almost like Putin's world. This story is almost like a metaphor for this post-fact world that Putin has driven us into. What do you see going on here, James?
Brian, wait a second. If nothing has happened, then there are no facts. What there are facts about is that over the past 2 months, and particularly in the last month, the level of military activity and of attacks by the Russians and their proxies in eastern Ukraine in the non-ceasefire in Donbass has been steadily rising. And more advanced equipment has been appearing as well. More of the digital drones that find out immediately where the Ukrainians are, so they don't have to fire as many shells to hit absolutely everything they're aiming at. This has been steadily mounting, and there has been no Western media coverage. And if there has been any Western governmental reaction,
I have to cut you off there, James. I've been harping on it relentlessly on my blog, but.
I'm sorry. I'm talking about local.
No, I understand what you
national-based media. My apologies. If there has been any political reaction from the West, I haven't heard it. The only thing we continue to hear is the usual recitation of the line in the catechism that we would like to see more moderate, that both sides need to observe a ceasefire when it's quite clear only one side is violating it. Even if you read the reports of the Special Monitoring Mission
Yeah, no, it's crystal clear. It's crystal clear.
This is all crystal clear and documented, but governments are afraid to say so. Now, so what might be driving all of this? Two things. First, there are Russia State Duma elections coming up, and there are obvious incentives to demonstrate that we have enemies. But our enemies respect us, and we have the upper hand, and Russia will not be pushed around. But secondly, and I think more fundamentally, the more fundamental issue is that the EU, thanks to Brexit, on top of everything else, is now becoming, even by its usual standards, deeply embroiled within itself. That's perhaps an awkward metaphor.
No, that's a perfect metaphor.
No, I apologize. I'm laughing because, I can't tell you how many transatlantic, meetings and conferences and summits I've been to over the last 15 years where inevitably on the European side, it's all about how, well, we're going to have to focus on our internal problems. I completely agree with the assessment. It's not like this is...
Dan, the point is that despite, the point is for the past 2 years, despite the obvious lines of tension and cleavage in the EU, we've had a unified sanctions policy and we've had a fair amount of robustness on Russia.
Yes.
That's fair.
So, we've defied the stereotype for a good 2 years. Now we have Brexit. And all the pieces are in motion again. And the Russians see us as being profoundly distracted. What I cannot say, I don't even have a view about it, is whether all these accusations and the troop mobilizations and the rotations are the prelude to a major escalation of the kind we saw in January 2015, or if they are simply the most elaborate means yet of frightening the West and pushing the West to put unbearable pressure on Petro Poroshenko to concede Russia's terms, which incidentally is not about special status, whatever that means for these two regions of Donbass, because what those regions are really demanding is a form of special status for Ukraine. What they're demanding is a settlement that prevents Ukraine, that keeps Ukraine neutral and prevents it from joining the EU or moving closer to the EU or NATO without their consent. And the EU does keep putting pressure on Ukraine, despite the fact that that's the demand. So it could mean either. People have also pointed out that troops are rotating because this is the time for them to rotate in those areas. And then also, secondly, the annual Kavkaz exercise is about to begin. That's not comforting because whenever Russia's intervened anywhere, including Georgia, in 2000,
been preceded by the Kavkaz exercise
of troop rotations and exercises.
Yeah, and again, those movements, massive movements of troops to northern Crimea, northern occupied Crimea near mainland Ukraine, preceded all of this nonsense. But I will say,
I think frankly, my intuition tells me, if the Russians were planning to attack, the provocation would need to be much bigger, of the kind they could have pretty much legitimately pointed to in South Ossetia in 2008, or there would be no warning at all. Mm. They wouldn't start pounding every table in the room and getting everybody's attention and then attack. Mm-hmm. It's a bit too obvious.
So you see it as a political
move. Stupid as our government, many of our governments are, they are not that stupid.
Now, if this were just a Daniel, do you have any thoughts on this before I move on?
No, I would tend to agree with James mostly on this. It has all the feel of a domestic ploy, but the problem is you're right. We can't ever tell completely. And, August is the month where Russia went into Georgia as well. So
during the Olympics as well.
Right.
During the Olympics and during a U.S. presidential campaign.
Right. And also it was the month when they ramped up their actions in eastern Ukraine when it seemed like their proxies were about to lose. So, I can't entirely dismiss it either.
Now, James, I would say if this was a political move, if it was aimed at Russia, that's one thing. And I've seen the argument out there. Valery Solovoy, the professor at MGMO, had made this argument on Kasparov.ru in a piece yesterday. But if this is aimed at the West to put pressure on Ukraine, it does seem to be failing. because everybody seems to be seeing through this. Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, has said we've seen no evidence of any of this. These things that Russia has said is going on are going on. Ukraine came out today with a couple of very interesting statements. The so-called saboteur that Russia arrested turns out to be a truck driver from Zaporizhia that is apparently kidnapped not far from his home. And there indeed was a shootout in the boundary between occupied Crimea and mainland Ukraine. But it was a shootout that only involved Russians. There was apparently, I'm not sure if it was deserters, but it only involved Russian forces, is what the Ukrainian intelligence. So holes are already being poked in this thing. And
if two rival gangs of smugglers started shooting at their respective cars, they could dress this up into the beginning of a war. And Ukrainians immediately, I mean, they know their history very well. They said it's like the concentration camp victims who were dressed up in Polish uniforms and sent to attack Germany in 1939. The basic question you have to ask about all this, about what the Russians claim, the Russians, you know, in Russian, it's «Кому это выгодно?» Who benefits? That's the thing. How can Ukraine, at such a point, when it is facing mounting attacks in the east, when Crimea is like every blade of grass there is now mobilized. The Crimea is effectively under the jurisdiction of
the Ministry
of Defense. It is like a hedgehog. You don't want to go near it. How in these circumstances could any Ukrainian, apart from a drunken smuggler or truck driver, wish to go near the place? It makes no sense at all.
So it's becoming increasingly clear that this looks like a provocation. They're just the only thing that I've been wondering is what does it portend?
They're hard to know the purpose of it. When Vladimir Putin says this must be put right, two Russian soldiers have been killed and they must answer for this. What does that mean exactly? Who is the audience and what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, no, and one argument is that they're tearing up the Minsk agreement because they're seeing it's not working for
this,
them.
Sorry, now finally, you awakened that part of my mind. This, I suspect, may be what it is really about because they have postponed, they have suspended the meetings of the Normandy format, and that's very interesting, which might suggest that. Despite my despondency about the way Minsk is interpreted, they might be coming to the conclusion that Ukraine and its Western partners are not willing to budge sufficiently to give us the terms we want. Mm-hmm. So we are now thinking beyond the Minsk agreement, and we want our Western partners to know we are thinking beyond it. And maybe that thought will frighten them a bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that ominous note, I guess we can wrap up for this week. That's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you that you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Oxford, England, has been veteran Kremlin watcher James Scher, an associate fellow with Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program. Also joining us via Skype from Newton, Massachusetts, has been Daniel Dresner, a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a columnist for the Washington Post and author of the books Theories of International Relations, International Politics and Zombies, and the recently published The System Work, How the World Stopped Another Great Depression. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion. You can always count on an interesting and intelligent talk with you two on.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.